There was a row of alarm clocks on the table by Jeremy's bed. He did not need them, because he woke up when he wanted to. They were there for testing. He set them for 7 and woke up at 6:59 to check that they went off on time. Tonight he went to bed early, with a drink of water and the grim fairy tales. He had never been interested in stories at any age, and had never quite understood the basic concept. He'd never read a work of fiction all the way through. He did remember, as a small boy, being really annoyed at the depiction of Hickory Dickory Dock in a rag book of nursery rhymes, because the clock in the drawing was completely wrong for the period. He tried to read grim fairy tales. They had titles like How the Wicked Queen Danced in Red Hot Shoes, and The Old Lady in the Oven. There was simply no mention of clocks of any sort in any of them. Their authors seemed to have a thing about not mentioning clocks. The glass clock of Bart Shoeshine, on the other hand, did have a clock, of a sort. And it was odd. A wicked man, readers could see he was wicked, because it said he was wicked, right there on the page, built a clock of glass, in which he captured time herself. But things went wrong because there was one part of the clock, a spring, that he couldn't make out of glass, and it broke under the strain. Time was set free, and the man aged 10,000 years in a second and crumpled to dust, and, not surprisingly in Jeremy's opinion, was never seen again. The story ended with a moral. Large enterprises depend upon small details. Jeremy couldn't see why it couldn't just as well have been "It's wrong to trap non-existent women in clocks," or "It would have worked with a glass spring." But even to Jeremy's inexperienced eye, there was something wrong with the whole story. It read as though the writer was trying to make sense of something he'd seen, or been told, and had misunderstood. And, ha! Although it was set hundreds of years ago, when even in Oberwald there were only natural cuckoo clocks, the artist had drawn a long-case clock of the sort that wasn't around even 15 years ago. The stupidity of some people! You'd laugh if it wasn't so tragic. He put the book aside and spent the rest of the evening doing a little design work for the guild. They paid him handsomely for this, providing he promised never to turn up in person. Then he put the work on the bedside table by the clocks. He blew out the candle. He went to sleep. He dreamed. The glass clock ticked. It stood in the middle of the workshop's wooden floor, giving off a silvery light. Jeremy walked around it, or perhaps it spun gently around him. It was taller than a man. Within the transparent case, red and blue lights twinkled like stars. The air smelled of acid. Now his point of view dived into the thing, the crystalline thing, plunging down through the layers of glass and quartz. They rose past him, their smoothness becoming walls hundreds of miles high, and still he fell between slabs that were becoming rough, grainy, full of holes. The blue and red light was here too, pouring past him, and only now was there sound. It came from the darkness ahead, a slow beat that was ridiculously familiar, a heartbeat magnified a million times. Chum! Chum! Each beat slower than mountains and bigger than worlds, dark and blood-red. He heard a few beats, and then his fall slowed, stopped, and he began to soar back up through the sleeting light until the brightness ahead became a room. He had to remember all this. It was all so clear once you saw it, so simple, so easy. He could see every part, how they interlocked, how they were made. And now it began to fade. Of course it was only a dream. He told himself that and was comforted by it. But he had gone to some lengths with this one, he had to admit. For example, there was a mug of tea steaming on the nearby workbench, and the sound of voices on the other side of the door. There was a knocking at the door. Jeremy wondered if the dream would end when the door was opened, and then the door disappeared and the knocking went on. It was coming from downstairs. The time was 6:47. Jeremy glanced at the alarm clocks to make sure they were right, then pulled his dressing gown around him and hurried downstairs. He opened the front door a crack. There was no one there.
"Dad, down here, mister."
Somewhere lower down was a dwarf.
"Name of Clockson," it said.
"Yes." A clipboard was thrust through the gap.
"Sign here, where it says sign here, thank you. Okay, lads."
Behind him, a couple of trolls tipped up a handcart. A large wooden crate crashed onto the cobbles.
"What is this?" said Jeremy. "Express package," said the dwarf, taking the clipboard. "Come all the way from Uberbout. Must have cost someone a packet. Look at all them seals and stickers on it."
"Can't you bring it in?" Jeremy began, but the cart was already moving off, with the merry jingle and tinkle of fragile items. It started to rain. Jeremy peered at the label on the crate. It was certainly addressed to him, in a neat round hand, and just above it was the seal with the double-headed bat of Uberwald. There was no other marking, except, near the bottom, and upside down, the words, "This side up." Then the crate started to swear. It was muffled, and in a foreign language, but all swearing has a certain international content.
Hello?
Said Jeremy. The crate rocked and landed on one of the long sides with extra cursing. There was some thumping from inside, some louder swearing, and the crate teetered upright again, with the alleged top the right way up. A piece of board slid aside, and a crowbar dropped out and onto the street with a clang. The voice that had lately been swearing said,
"If you would be so good."
Jeremy inserted the bar into a likely-looking crack and pulled. The crate sprang apart. He dropped the bar. There was a creature inside.
"I don't know," it said, pulling bits of packing material off itself. "8 bloody days with no problems, and those idiots get it wrong on the doorstep."
It nodded at Jeremy.
"Good morning, sir. I suppose you are Mr. Jeremy?"
"Yes, but..."
"My name is Igor, sir. My credentials, sir."
A hand like an industrial accident, held together with stitches, thrust a sheaf of papers towards Jeremy. He recoiled instinctively, and then felt embarrassed and took them.
"I think there's been a mistake," he said.
"No, no mistake," said Igor,
pulling a carpet bag out of the ruins of the crate.
"You need an assistant, and when it comes to assistance, you cannot go wrong with an Igor. Everyone knows that. Could we go in out of the rain, sir? It's making my knees rust."
"But I don't need an
Jeremy began, but that was wrong, wasn't it? He just couldn't keep assistants. They always left within a week.
"Morning, sir," said a cheery voice.
Another cart had pulled up. This one was painted a gleaming hygienic white and was full of milk churns, and had "Ronald Soak Dairyman" painted on the side. Distracted, Jeremy looked up at the beaming face of Mr. Soak, who was holding a bottle of milk in each hand.
"One pint, squire, as per usual, and perhaps another one if you've got company."
Yes, thank you."
"And the yoghurt is particularly fine this week, squire?"
said Mr. Soak encouragingly.
I think not, Mr. Soak. Need any eggs, cream, butter, buttermilk or cheese?"
"Not as such, Mr. Soak."
"Right you are, then," said Mr. Soak, unabashed. "See you tomorrow, then."
Yes, said Jeremy, as the cart moved on. Mr. Soak was a friend, which in Jeremy's limited social vocabulary meant someone I speak to once or twice a week. He approved of the milkman because he was regular and punctual and had the bottles at the doorstep every morning on the stroke of 7 a.m.
Goodbye, he said.
He turned to Igor.
"How did you know I needed—"
he tried. But the strange man had gone indoors, and a frantic Jeremy tracked him down in the workshop.
"Oh, yes, very nice,"
said Igor, who was taking it all in with the air of a connoisseur.
"That's a Turnbull Mark III micro-lathe, isn't it? I saw that in their catalogue. Very nice, indeed."
"I didn't ask anyone for an assistant," said Jeremy.
Who sent you?
We are Igor's, sir.
Yes, you said. Look, I don't...
No, sir. We are Igor's, sir. The organisation, sir.
What organisation?
For placements, sir. You see, sir, the thing is, an Igor often finds himself between masters, through no fault of his own, you see, and, on the other hand...
You have two thumbs, breathed Jeremy, who had just noticed and couldn't stop himself. Two on each hand.
Oh, yes, sir, very handy, said Igor, not even glancing down. On the other hand, there is no shortage of people wanting an Igor, so my Aunt Igorina runs our select little agency.
For lots of Igors, said Jeremy.
Oh, there's a fair number of us. We're a big family.
Igor handed Jeremy a card. He read, We are Igors, a spare hand when needed. The Old Rathaus, Bart Schuschein, C-mail, Yes, Master, Überwalt. Jeremy stared at the semaphore address. His normal ignorance of anything that wasn't to do with clocks did not apply here. He'd been quite interested in the new cross-continent semaphore system, after hearing that it made quite a lot of use of clockwork mechanisms to speed up the message flow. So you could send a clax message to hire an Igor. Well, that explained the speed, at least. Rathaus, he said. That means something like a council hall, doesn't it?
Normally, sir. Normally, said Igor reassuringly.
Do you really have semaphore addresses in Überwalt?
Oh, yes. We are ready to grasp the future with both hands, sir.
And four thumbs?
Yes, sir. We can grasp like anything.
And then you mailed yourself here?
Certainly, sir. We Igors are no strangers to discomfort.
Jeremy looked down at the paperwork he'd been handed, and a name caught his eye. The top paper was signed, in a way at least. There was a message in neat capitals, as neat as printing, and a name at the end. He will be useful, Le Jean. He remembered. Oh, Lady Le Jean is behind this. She had you sent to me.
That's correct, sir.
Feeling that Igor was expecting more of him, Jeremy made a show of reading through the rest of what turned out to be references. Some of them were written in what he could only hope was dried brown ink. One was in crayon, and several were singed around the edges. They were all fulsome. After a while, though, a certain tendency could be noted amongst the signatories. This one is signed by someone called Mad Dr. Scoop, he said.
Oh, he wasn't actually named Mad, sir. It was more like a nickname, as it were.
Was he mad, then?
Who can say, sir? Said Igor calmly.
And crazed Baron Ha-Ha? It says under reason for leaving that he was crushed by a burning windmill.
Case of mistaken identity, sir.
Really?
Yes, sir. I understand the mob mistook him for screaming Dr. Berserk, sir.
Oh. Ah, yes. Jeremy glanced down. Who you also worked for, I see.
Yes, sir.
And who died of blood poisoning?
Yes, sir. Caused by a dirty pitchfork.
And Nipsey the Impaler?
Would you believe he ran a kebab shop, sir?
Did he?
Not conventionally, though, sir.
You mean he was mad too?
Ah, well, he did have his little ways, I must admit, but an Igor never passes judgment on his master or mistress, sir. That is the code of the Igors, sir,
he added patiently.
It would be a funny old world if we were all alike, sir.
Jeremy was completely baffled as to his next move. He'd never been very good at talking to people, and this, apart from Lady Le Jean and a wrangle with Mr. Soak over an unwanted cheese, was the longest conversation he'd had for a year. Perhaps it was because it was hard to think of Igor as coming under the heading of people. Until now, Jeremy's definition of people had not included anyone with more stitches than a handbag. "I'm not sure I've got any work for you, though," he said. "I've got a new commission, but I'm not sure how... Anyway, I'm not insane."
"That's not compulsory, sir."
"I've actually got a piece of paper that says I'm not, you know."
"Well done, sir."
"Not many people have one of those."
"Very true, sir."
"I take medicine, you know."
"Well done, sir," said Igor. "I'll just go and make some breakfast, shall I? While you get dressed, master."
Jeremy clutched at his damp dressing gown. "I'll be down shortly," he said, and hurried up the stairs. Igor's gaze took in the racks of tools. There was not a speck of dust on them. The files, hammers, and pliers were ranged according to size, and the items on the workbench were positioned with geometrical exactitude. He pulled open a drawer. Screws were laid in perfect rows. He looked around at the walls. They were bare, except for the shelves of clocks. This was surprising. Even dribbling Dr. Vibes had a calendar on the wall, which added a splash of colour. Admittedly, it was from the Acid Bath and Restraint Company, and ugly, and the colour it splashed was mostly red, but at least it showed some recognition of a world outside the four walls. Igor was puzzled. Igor had never worked for a sane person before. He'd worked for a number of... well, the world called them madmen, and he'd worked for several normal people, in that they only indulged in minor and socially acceptable insanities, but he couldn't recall ever working for a completely sane person. Obviously, he reasoned, if sticking screws up your nose was madness, then numbering them and keeping them in careful compartments was sanity, which was the opposite. Ah, no, it wasn't, was it? He smiled. He was beginning to feel quite at home already. Lutsay the sweeper was in his garden of five surprises, carefully cultivating his mountains. His broom leaned against the hedge. Above him, looming over the temple gardens, the big stone statue of Wen the Eternally Surprised sat with its face locked in its permanent, wide-eyed expression of... yes, pleasant surprise. As a hobby, mountains appeal to those people who in normal circumstances are said to have a great deal of time on their hands. Lutsay had no time at all. Time was something that largely happened to other people. He viewed it in the same way that people on the shore viewed the sea. It was big, and it was out there, and sometimes it was an invigorating thing to dip a toe into, but you couldn't live in it all the time. Besides, it always made his skin wrinkle. At the moment, in the never-ending, ever-recreated moment of this peaceful, sunlit little valley, he was fiddling with the little mirrors and shovels and morphic resonators and even stranger devices required to make a mountain grow to no more than 6 inches high. The cherry trees were still in bloom. They always were in bloom here. A gong rang somewhere back in the temple. A flock of white doves took off from the monastery roof. A shadow fell over the mountain. Lutsay glanced at the person who had entered the garden. He made the perfunctory symbol of servitude to the rather annoyed-looking boy in novice's robes.
"Yes, master," he said.
"I'm looking for the one they call Lutsay," said the boy. "Personally, I don't think he really exists."
"I've got glaciation," said Lutsay, ignoring this. "At last. See, master, it's only an inch long, but already it's carving its own little valley. Magnificent, isn't it?"
"Yes, yes, very good," said the novice, being kind to an underling. "Isn't this the garden of Lutsay?"
"You mean Lutsay, who is famous for his bonsai mountains?"
The novice looked from the line of plates to the little wrinkled smiling man. "You a Lutsay? But you're just a sweeper. I've seen you cleaning out the dormitories. I've seen people kick you." Lutsay, apparently not hearing this, picked up a plate about a foot across on which a small cinder cone was smoking.
"What do you think of this, master?" he said. "Volcanic, and it is bloody hard to do, excuse my clatching."
The novice took a step forward and leaned down and looked directly into the sweeper's eyes. Lutze was not often disconcerted, but he was now.
"You are Lutze?" "Yes, lad, I am Lutze."
The novice took a deep breath and thrust out a skinny arm. It was holding a small scroll. "From the abbot, venerable one." The scroll wobbled in the nervous hand.
"Most people call me Lutze, lad, or sweeper. Until they get to know me better, some call me Get Out of the Way," said Lutze, carefully wrapping up his tools. "I've never been very venerable, except in cases of bad spelling."
He looked around the saucers for the miniature shovel he used for glacial work, and couldn't see it anywhere. Surely he'd put it down just a moment ago. The novice was watching him with an expression of awe mixed with residual suspicion. A reputation like Lutze's got around. This was the man who had, well, who had done practically everything if you listened to the rumours. But he didn't look as though he had. He was just a little bald man, with a wispy beard and a faint, amiable smile. Lutze patted the young man on the shoulder in an effort to put him at his ease.
"Let us see what the abbot wants," he said, unrolling the rice paper. "Oh, you are to take me to see him, it says here."
A look of panic froze the novice's face.
"What? How can I do that? Novices aren't allowed inside the inner temple." "Really? In that case, let me take you, to take me, to see him," said Lutze.
"You are allowed into the inner temple," said the novice, and then put his hand over his mouth.
"But you're just a Oh. "That's right. Not even a proper monk, let alone a dong," said the sweeper cheerfully. "Amazing, isn't it?"
"But people talk about you as if you were as high as the abbot."
"Oh, dear me, no," said Lutze. "I'm nothing like as holy. Never really got a grip on the cosmic harmony."
"But you've done all those incredible—"
I didn't say I'm not good at what I do," said Lutze, ambling away with his broom over his shoulder. "Just not holy. Shall we go?"
Lutze, said the novice as they walked along the ancient brick path.
"Yes?"
"Why is this called the Garden of Five Surprises?"
"What was your name back in the world, hasty young man?" said Lutze.
"Newgate. Newgate Lud Ven—" Lutze held up a warning finger.
"Ah?"
"Sweeper, I mean."
"Lad, eh? Ankh-Morpork lad?"
"Yes, sweeper," said the boy. The suddenly dejected tone suggested he knew what was coming next.
"Raised by the Thieves Guild, one of Lud's lads."
The boy, formerly known as Newgate, looked the old man in the eye, and when he replied, it was in the sing-song voice of someone who'd answered the question too many times. "Yes, sweeper, yes, I was a foundling. Yes, we get called Lud's lads and lasses after one of the founders of the guild. Yes, that's my adopted surname. Yes, it was a good life, and sometimes I still wish I had it." Lutze appeared not to hear this.
"Who sent you here?"
"A monk called Soto discovered me. He said I had talent."
"Marco? The one with all the hair?"
"That's right. Only I thought the rule was that all monks were shaved."
"Oh, Soto says he is bald under the hair," said Lutze. "He says the hair is a separate creature that just happens to live on him. They gave him a field posting really quickly after he came up with that one. Hard-working fellow, mind you, and friendly as anything, providing you don't touch his hair. Important lesson there. You don't survive in the field by obeying all the rules, including those relating to mental processes. And what name were you given when you were enrolled?"
"Lobsang Ven— Sweeper."
"Lobsang Lud?"
Yes, sweeper."
"Amazing. So, Lobsang Lud, you tried to count my surprises, did you? Everybody does. Surprise is the nature of time, and five is the number of surprise."
"Yes, sweeper. I found the little bridge that tilts and throws you into the carp pool."
"Good, good.
And I have found the bronze sculpture of a butterfly that flaps its wings when you breathe on it."
"That's two."
There's the surprising way those little daisies spray you with venomous pollen.
Ah, yes. Many people find them extremely surprising.
And I believe the fourth surprise is the yodeling stick insect.
Well done, said Lutze, beaming. It's very good, isn't it?
But I can't find the fifth surprise.
Really? Let me know when you find it, said Lutze.
Lobsang Lud thought about this as he trailed after the sweeper. The Garden of Five Surprises is a test, he said at last.
Oh, yes. Nearly everything is.
Lobsang nodded. It was like the Garden of the Four Elements. Every novice found the bronze symbols of three of them, in the carp pond, under a rock, painted on a kite. But none of Lobsang's classmates found fire. There didn't appear to be a fire anywhere in the garden. After a while, Lobsang had reasoned thus. There were, in fact, five elements, as they had been taught. Four made up the universe, and the fifth, surprise, allowed it to keep on happening. No one had said that the four in the garden were the material four, so the fourth element in the garden could be surprise at the fact that fire wasn't there. Besides, fire was not generally found in the garden, and the other signs were truly in their element. So he'd gone down to the bakeries and opened one of the ovens, and there, glowing red-hot below the loaves, was fire.
Then I expect that the fifth surprise is there is no fifth surprise, he said. Nice try, but no cylindrical smoking thing, said Lutze. And is it not written, oh, you are so sharp you'll cut yourself one of these days?
I haven't read that in the sacred texts yet, sweeper, said Lobsang uncertainly.
No, you wouldn't have, said Lutze.
They stepped out of the brittle sunlight into the deep cold of the temple, and walked on through ancient halls and down stairways cut into the rock. The sound of distant chanting followed them. Lutze, who was not holy and therefore could think unholy thoughts, occasionally wondered whether the chanting monks were chanting anything, or were just going, ah, ha, ha. You could never tell with all that echo. He turned off the main passage and reached for the handles of a pair of large, red, lacquered doors. Then he looked behind him. Lobsang had stopped dead some yards away.
Coming?
But not even dongs are allowed in there, said Lobsang. You have to be a third Jim Ting, at least.
Yeah, right. It's a shortcut. Come on, it's drafty out here.
With extreme reluctance, expecting at any moment the outraged scream of authority, Lobsang trailed after the sweeper. And he was just a sweeper. One of the people who swept the floors and washed the clothes and cleaned the privies. No one had ever mentioned it. Novices heard about Lutze from their very first day. How he'd gone into some of the most tangled knots of time and unravelled them. How he'd constantly dodged the traffic on the crossroads of history. How he could divert time with a word and use this to develop the most subtle arts of battle. And here was a skinny little man who was sort of generically ethnic, so that he looked as if he could have come from anywhere, in a robe that had once been white before it fell to all those stains and patches, and the sandals repaired with string, and the friendly grin, as if he was constantly waiting for something amusing to happen, and no belt at all, just another piece of string to hold his robe closed. Even some novices got to the level of grey dong in their first year. The dojo was busy with senior monks at practice. Lobsang had to dodge aside as a pair of fighters whirled past, arms and legs blurring as each sought an opening, paring time into thinner and thinner slivers.
"Yo, sweeper!"
Lobsang looked around, but the shout had been directed at Lutze. A ting, only just elevated to the third Jim by the fresh look of his belt, was advancing on the little man, his face red with fury.
"What for are you coming in here, cleaner of filth? This is forbidden!"
Lutze's little smile didn't change, but he reached in his robe and brought out a small bag.
"It's a shortcut," he said.
He pulled a pearl of tobacco and, while the ting loomed over him, began to roll a cigarette.
"And there's dirt everywhere, too. I'll certainly have a word with the man who does this floor. How dare your insult!" screamed the monk. "Back to the kitchens with you, sweeper!"
Cowering behind Lu Tse, Lobsang realized that the entire dojo had stopped to watch this. One or two of the monks were whispering to one another. The man in the brown robe of the dojo master was watching impassively from his chair with his chin on his hand. With great and patient and infuriating delicacy, like a samurai arranging flowers, Lu Tse marshalled the shreds of tobacco in the flimsy cigarette paper.
"Now I reckon I'll go out of that door over there, if you don't mind," he said. "Impudence! Then you are ready to fight, enemy of dust!"
The man leapt back and raised his hands to form the combat of the hake. He spun round and planted a kick on a heavy leather sack, hitting it so hard that its supporting chain broke. Then he was back to face Lu Tse, hands held in the advancement of the snake.
"Hai! Shao! Hai!"
he began. The dojo master stood up.
"Hold!"
he commanded.
"Do you not want to know the name of the man you are about to destroy?"
The fighter held his stance, glaring at Lu Tse.
"I don't need to know the name of sweeper," he said.
Lu Tse rolled the cigarette into a skinny cylinder and winked at the angry man, which only stoked the anger.
"It is always wise to know the name of a sweeper, boy," said the dojo master. "And my question was not addressed to you."
Tick.